Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, March 30th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Steve.
And with us later in the program, we'll hear from Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. We'll talk to George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands, Jeff. Let's start at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant in Plymouth. Mm-hmm. Early this week, we learned about another equipment issue at the plant, and this was about some parts for an emergency system that were installed improperly.
That's right, Steve. A busy week for Pilgrim, as they all are, they seem. But the third mechanical problem in as many weeks was discovered, as you had said, Steve, this week. There were some faulty clamps that were found, and these are very important components to the control rods in the nuclear plant that need to be in perfect working order in case something happens in the power plant needs to shut down. Considerably dangerous situation here, but looks as if they're on their way to be fixed. Of course, the power plant is closed right now, and there is a solution if something were to happen at the plant and these clamps weren't working. It's called what they call a poison solution. It's literally liquid boron, which would be sent in to stop nuclear fission.
Which is a last case scenario.
It's last resort,
yeah.
Never been used, but almost was used in Alabama at Brown's Ferry in the 1980s. But luckily on the fourth try and getting the rods to work, they had to scrap the idea of using that. So we don't know what would have happened. One good thing, positive remark that's come out of this is David Lockbaum, who's the director of the Nuclear Safety Program, the Union of Concerned Scientists, says by finding this, these faulty clamps, it shows the workers haven't turned a blind eye toward the conditions as they get ready for the shutdown of the plant.
That is one spin to put on
this. I guess.
Even before this plant shut down for this particular issue, it's been shut down, I guess, since March 6th, it looks like.
Yep.
For there's been a little cascade of issues that they were first dealing with a leak within one of the systems.
Right.
And then they found a transformer problem, mm-hmm. and now they found this.
Right, and the transformer problem happened to occur right around March 13th, which if we take a look back, we remember we were getting hit by a pretty strong blizzard that day. So still not clear whether or not the weather played a factor there.
Then on Monday night, following news of this problem with the clamps, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission held its annual assessment of the Pilgrim plant. This was in Plymouth. A lot of people come out for this. What did we hear?
They do. This happens every year. They had the 2017 performance review. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission was there. Of course, the opponents to Pilgrim were there, as were a lot of plant workers. So it was a heated debate that was going on there. But the message that came out of that, the main message, Chief, from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was Pilgrim needs to do more and show more progress and improve operations at the plant, not only just fixing errors that are found, but they need to make sure the sustainability when they mm-hmm. consider all the repairs they need to make. And they need to address the issues that have been ID'd. As we know, that's Pilgrim is still a Category 4 plant in the matrix that is used to measure performance, and that's one step above being shut down.
That's the lowest before the mandatory shutdown. Yeah,
it is. And for the entire year 2017, there were 15 violations found at Pilgrim, and already many more in 2018. So we'll see what happens here. As we know, the plant is now in its 24th day of shutdown.
So the NRC feeling like the Pilgrim has had a history of these issues, but doesn't the NRC was saying that their concern really is whether they can continue to have a culture of safety going forward, looking ahead.
That's right, because once it shuts down in May of 2019, it's just not going away, and they need to start thinking about sustainable safety operations. One thing that I noticed from Christine Legia's story, which I found very interesting, was our Attorney General Maura Healey has been weighing in on this lately.
Mm-hmm.
She was a bit concerned that the plant did not shut down during that strong northeaster we had on March 2nd. when the National Weather Service determined that due to fallen wires, fallen trees, like what likely to happen, the damage.
Flooding intersections.
Flooding. You would not have been able to evacuate from that 10-mile radius around
right.
the plant.
So it was a concern that if something had happened, you would
right.
not have been able to evacuate, and that the plant right. is perhaps should not have been operating through
right.
that storm.
I'm sure we're going to hear more from her office on this as well.
Well, I know that the spokesperson for Mara Healey was at that assessment, the annual assessment, and said that she's really pushing for more oversight, not
mm-hmm.
less, going
right.
forward. And again, as you mentioned, there were many people who turned out from Plymouth and workers mm-hmm. at the plant speaking in support of the plant, saying that they're really working hard and that working hard to have a culture of safety, and that without this plant, you know, there's a question about what happens to the energy grid. This is considered a clean source of energy.
That's right. And one of the workers said, of course, we go to work every day. Safety is on our mind. So,
yeah. Let's turn to another story, an effort at the State House to tax short-term rentals. These are rentals like you might typically find on Airbnb. This is moving forward, and some towns are already looking forward to the potential to get some revenue from this,
mm-hmm.
it sounds like.
Yeah, we've been talking about this, I'm guessing, for the better part of a year. And this is taxing short-term rentals, as you mentioned, Airbnb, HomeAway, and just people who have a cottage and want to rent it for the summer. It was brought up before the House of Representatives this week, and it passed 117-30 to move forward to the Senate to discuss this short-term rental tax. And earlier, when this was first being discussed, I spoke with some people, and they said, really, what it's intended to do is create a level playing field, because, you know, hotel owners, bed and breakfast owners were complaining,
mm-hmm.
you know. All of these people online are pretty much doing the same things we're doing, but we have to pay tax. We have to make sure that our properties are inspected by
mm-hmm.
the boards of health, by the building inspector.
The fire, yes.
But one interesting thing that came out of this House vote last week was Representative Sarah Peek, she's from Provincetown, was able to get an amendment tacked onto this bill. And she had the support of the entire delegation down here. And her amendment calls for the addition of 2.75% for this tax here on the Cape and Islands that would be used as a funding stream to help with what we're estimated to be a $4 billion wastewater cleanup here on the Cape. And the money would go back to the towns, probably about $5 million a year in the form of low-interest loans and grants. And it would be funneled into a fund called the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund.
And some towns, it sounds like, might even be able to get paid back for work they've already done on wastewater.
Right. That's right. Barnstable, Falmouth, Chatham, they've already made some progress on that with sewering, so they may be able to get paid back. And Senator Julian Sear has been a big proponent of this, and his senior advisor had a very interesting comment here. You know, it's not a very popular move, especially amongst people who are renting homes, real estate agents, et cetera. But she said, you know, why not have the people who visit the Cape help us pay for the infrastructure so that's going to make them want to come visit us again? So,
and as you said, I think a lot of people feel like it's a question of fairness,
mm-hmm.
that these people right. who are coming put a fair burden on the wastewater system and all the systems, the infrastructure, and here's a way to continue to keep the upkeep on all of this.
Exactly.
We should mention that that's just the House, Senate, mm-hmm. The State House bill, but there's one coming out of the State Senate that's a little bit different, and they're going to have to reconcile.
That's right. The Senate should be taking this up in the middle of April, and then they'll have to go to conference committee to work it out.
Let's speak with Sarah Brown, who's on the phone with us. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, a lot of angry frustration being expressed these days by Vineyard Ferry riders after 2 weeks of problems with two different ferries.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on here?
Yeah, like you said, it has been 2 weeks of a lot of frustration and a lot of just ongoing mechanical issues that are, you know, apparently unrelated but are happening with the two main passenger ferries right now between the Vineyard and Woods Hole. And that's the appropriately named Martha's Vineyard and Woods Hole ferries. And they're the two larger vessels in operation. And both of those ferries have just been in and out of service now for 2 weeks. It began with the Martha's Vineyard about almost 2 weeks ago, and it lost power in an incident that's been, you know, well-publicized. And since then, been coming in and out of service. And the Woods Hole has also had these kind of electrical issues or things with the circuit breaker. And so both of those have been, you know, it seems that one of them comes out and then the other one, you know, comes back in, and it's kind of rotating ferries right now. And last weekend, both of the ferries were out of service, and, you know, during the weekend, so the steamship was kind of scrambling with freight ferries filling in for the disabled boats. The ferry Gay Head was brought over, and even the Sea Streak ferry, the Whaling City Express, was chartered by the Steamship Authority to provide passenger-only service, so kind of zipping back and forth between mm-hmm. the Vineyard and Woods Hole. Which actually, I should add, that service has been really popular with a lot of people who say, this is great, it's so fast, it's, you know, 20 minutes. And that's back in service going into the holiday weekend, because this is, of course, probably a busier weekend with the Easter holiday and other holidays. And the Woods Hole is still out of for repairs as of today. Apparently a problem with a control panel. And the Martha's Vineyard has been back in service since yesterday morning. So the freight ferry Sankaty is continuing to fill in for the Woods Hole. Like I said, the Sea Streak is still running. And then this other wrinkle, the Island Home ferry, has been out for scheduled maintenance and dry docked since, I think, January. And it was scheduled originally to come back last weekend. There were some delays, and it was slated to come back tomorrow, or today, I guess. And then yesterday afternoon, Steamship Authority General Manager said, no, actually, during sea trials yesterday, there was an issue with the valve thruster, and that's also been delayed, so it's not coming back this weekend. So kind of another boat now that's a little bit delayed. So as you said, it's been very frustrating.
And I think, Sarah, I mean, one of the questions people keep raising here is that the Martha's Vineyard just finished this midlife mm-hmm. replacement. It cost more than $18 million, I think.
Yeah.
And Woods Hole is a relatively new ferry. So these mm-hmm. are two ferries people expect should be ready to go and serve the passenger line.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd think would be reliable. And actually, interestingly, you know, Robert Davis, the general manager, said they do think the problems with the Martha's Vineyard are probably related to that midlife $18.5 million refurbishment, that it seems that there are some issues with the work that was done. You know, there have been problems with the generators and, I guess, the circuit breaker this week, and those were things that were done during this midlife refurbishment. So it seems that somehow, you know, with that refurbishment, the ferry is having issues related to that, which is something it sounds like they're going to look into. You know, the Steamship Authorities, the Board of Governors, Martha's Vineyard representative, Mark Hanover, you know, he has been acknowledging that this is, you know, as he said, you know, really unacceptable, really horrendous. And he's actually calling for an independent marine consultant to come in and look at operations and look at what's going on. Because, you know, as you said, these two ferries, one's pretty new, just to see what the issues are and where they're stemming from.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
And we will have more ferry discussion later on. We are not done with this topic yet. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker, joined in the studio with Jeff Spillane here. And we're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, you've got an article this week looking at the way the winter storms have reshaped some of the coastline there in Chatham and some of the erosion impacts. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, it's no secret that the four nor'easters we had really played havoc with Chatham's eastern shoreline. But the long-term impact of that is only really starting to emerge now. With the flattening of much of South Beach, which is the barrier beach that stood between the Atlantic and the shoreline south of the lighthouse, that entire area is now subject to a lot of greater erosion and more frequent flooding. Even during the most recent storm, which didn't have much of an impact, other places that it sent floodwaters into this key intersection that people in the town say is going to continue to flood, even perhaps when there's no storm, when there's just high tides. Now, the situation is sort of becoming a serious for the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge headquarters, which is on Morris Island, which is south of that area. That because of that flooding at that intersection, their headquarters were inaccessible for 14 days during the flooding, mm-hmm. during the, you know, since between January and March. And the loss of South Beach used to protect the eastern side of the refuge property. Without that, with you know, the ocean waves really just crashing over South Beach and heading right onto the mainland there, it's significantly eroded those bluffs there. And they had to at the refuge, they had to close a trail and an overlook because they were in danger of falling over the eroded cliff there. Now, the refuge manager, Matt Hillman, he said that in the refuge's comprehensive plan, which was approved a couple years ago, it talks about preparing for an eventuality like that, but it kind of set the schedule to start doing that 5 years from now. Uh-huh. So he says we're really going to have to accelerate that schedule a little bit. And he said the plan presents several options, but in his words, none of them are very good. They include moving the entire refuge headquarters off of Morris Island. He said there's no space within their property there to really relocate the structures that they have. A couple of them, a couple of those structures could be in danger of, you know, being going over the cliff in a couple years if this erosion continues. A revetment is also a possibility, but he said, you know, we don't have any money for that. And number two, that's kind of antithetical to the the environmental mission that we have at the refuge. So they're going to have to be wrestling with that. And meanwhile, he's looking at helping out the town with flooding of that intersection, finding a way to floodproof that intersection. You know, the town's putting in some extra drainage basins so that they can pump it out quicker. Matt said he's looking into federal highway funds to maybe help raise that intersection. So there's a lot going on down there. And meanwhile, the refuge staff hasn't been able to get out to Monomoy Island itself because of the storms. And so he's not sure what kind of a shape the islands are in. And meanwhile, they're expecting the first shorebirds to arrive for the nesting season any day now. So so they're sort of they got a lot to do down there at the refuges. And like I said, it's sort of a bellwether for what's going on in that whole area.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
I have with me Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, last week we talked about a bill introduced by Representative Keating intended to protect reservation land for the Mashpee Wampanoag. That bill seemed to catch a lot of folks by surprise, including some local lawmakers.
It did. It did. This legislation was filed by Congressman Keating. And as we know, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe plans for a casino in Taunton, a $1 billion casino, have been kind of in limbo the past 6 months to a year as the Department of Interior takes another look at whether or not the land in trust designation was made appropriately. So Congressman Keating said, you know, he apparently got word that the DOI is going to make a decision soon and it's probably not going to go the tribe's way, so he filed this legislation, which would supersede any decision by the executive branch and would reaffirm the tribe's reservation in Mashpee and Taunton. And Ed Markey, Senator Markey, and Senator Warren filed a companion bill in the Senate this week. Problem is, the town of Mashpee was never notified that this was happening down there on Capitol Hill. And apparently this has been going on for months. And it's a little bit of a, well, I'm going to kind of say it's a kind of a slap in the face for the town, since they had just had a meeting with the tribe to discuss better communications between the two governments.
Although this meeting they just had came after a long time, apparently, of
several years of not
speaking with each other. So
that's right.
Communication is an issue here. Yeah.
That's right. And Selectman Andrew Gottlieb in Mashpee said that he had found out from Mark Forrest, who works for the Delahunt Group, which is a lobbying firm, and he's also a Yarmouth selectman, that this has been in the works for months. And Selectman Gottlieb said, you know, how can we support the tribe? They want our support every step of the way, I think, which they're willing to do, but they won't tell us what their next step is. So there was a little bit of contention that came out of this. Tom O'Hara, who's the chairman of the Board of Selectmen, is working on drafting a letter to the tribe to express their concerns over this.
Now, the tribe itself has kind of said that they They did bring this up in some manner during the meeting, but perhaps it was a
That's right. Chairman Cedric Cromwell said he did bring it up, and from reading Tanner Steining's article, looks like it may have been in passing. Perhaps nobody even caught on what it meant. Mm-hmm.
When he mentioned there could be a congressional solution
coming, that's right.
And then it went right by them, yeah.
Hopefully they can work this out.
The state is suspending some permitting requirements in the aftermath of our series of punishing storms. These have mostly to do with repairs along coastal areas. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. As we know, the month of March, we had four pretty major storms here on the Cape and Islands, did a lot of damage, a lot of coastal erosion, a lot of buildup of the dunes was needed after those storms. Problem is, the first storm hit us on March 2nd, but the state has a regulation that says after March 1st, you can't make any changes to existing sand dunes. It's part of their piping plover regulations. Uh-huh. So you had a lot of people here on the Cape and Islands very nervous. But the state has since said, we're going to come to your rescue. We're going to allow you to fix the damage. We're going to waive the permitting requirements. We're going to give you to April 2nd to do that. That would be for removal of debris from beaches, building repairs, fixing foundations, septic systems, utility repairs, really anything that would have to do with public safety or health. Mm-hmm. So they have until Monday to get this done. There's a chance it may be extended because of the storms that happened after March 2nd. And a good example of this permitting requirement being waived was the demolition of the snack bar at Nauset Beach, Liam's.
Uh-huh.
And to date, 95 applications have been filed for waiving of the permits. 50 of them from the Cape, with Sandwich has the most at 15.
And a lot, it sounds like towns all around the region are scrambling to take advantage of this this window in
they
which
are.
They can get this work done. And piping plovers expected to show up sometime in April.
Right.
And so there's a lot to be done before it's shut down to be able to reinforce the beaches or fix
exactly.
things that have come down in the storms.
And something the state wants towns to know, and people who have filed for these applications, you can only fix what was damaged. This isn't a free pass to expand bridges, seawalls, or anything. So,
Canada has issued new safeguards to protect North Atlantic right whales. This is coming after last year, which saw a number of right whale deaths associated with the Canadian fishery.
Yeah, our neighbors from the north are getting serious about this, Steve, and protecting the right whales. The Canadian government this week announced new restrictions to help protect the declining right whale population, which I think is right around 450 now.
Yes.
And the new restrictions include more rules and regulations around snow crab fishing and ship speeds. And they're also throwing $1 million more in to help marine mammals and their detanglements from fishing here, helping them get out of there. Last year, 12 right whales died in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. They had moved from our area up there, and most of them were either hit by ships or entangled in fishing gear. So it did become a big problem. And the Defenders of Wildlife, which is a United States group, which is suing the National Marine Fisheries Service, says that this is a great thing, and hopefully we'll see the United States pick up and do the same thing Canada's doing.
Well, these whales, they're migratory, so they're moving along the coast. They're not paying attention to U.S. or Canadian boundaries.
They're not.
And they're moving up there. Last year we saw, I think, 17 right whale, North Atlantic right whale deaths, and as you say, 12 of those coming in Canadian waters. And in a population with something less than 450 left, they really, scientists and researchers are starting to talk about them being on a path toward extinction if we can't do something, intervene.
That's right. We're not seeing a lot of calves being born.
We are going to speak right now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Ed, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, there's been a good deal of heat and contention around a proposal to expand the White Crest Beach parking lot in Wellfleet. Bring us up to date on this.
Yes, okay. Well, the latest development in this ongoing saga, which has had an amazing number of twists and turns at this point, is that the selectmen's proposal to expand that parking lot at the White Crest Beach which they had put on the warrant and unanimously recommended for passage earlier this month, is now off the warrant following this week's meeting of the selectmen. They changed their minds, and there won't be any vote on that project, at least at this town meeting. The backstory here, of course, is related to those increasingly intense storms that have been eroding the back shore here on the Outer Cape, and particularly affecting the parking lots at the four ocean beaches that are managed by the town of Wellfleet. As you probably remember, the parking lot at Cahoon Hollow Beach, where the Beachcomber restaurant is, collapsed last August, and the town now has decided not to reopen that one. Over the past several years, the town has lost a large number of parking spaces in its parking lots along the beach. The number isn't exactly clear, but Selectman Dennis Murphy said at a forum last week that the town has lost between 300 and 350 parking spaces in the last 10 years.
That's a lot of parking spaces.
It's a lot. The aerial surveys and photographs of the beaches confirm that is true. And the effect of that is, of course, more and more people come to go to the beach every summer. These are spectacular beaches that are very popular. And if you come and look for a parking space in July or August, chances are you're going to have to wait in a long line. People are driving up and down looking for a spot. There's more and more illegal parking, and the roads are more and more dangerous, especially with the Cape Cod Rail Trail dumping bicyclers and walkers out onto this stretch of ocean. And so the town has been working for several years to figure out a solution to this. And the plan that the planners came up with was to expand this one parking lot that exists on the across the road, Ocean View Drive, from the ocean, which is less jeopardized by erosion, since it's further from the edge of the dunes there. But there were a lot of questions about the plan. In some ways, it wasn't really clearly delineated by town officials. But the other thing that really affected the decision, I think, was an intense effort that was mounted by property owners in the area of Whitecrest Beach, who conducted quite an intensive email campaign and hired a lawyer to write a letter to the selectmen suggesting somewhat obliquely that they might face legal action. There were many twists in the story where over the period of about a week before this last selectmen's meeting, the chairman, at least, changed his mind a minimum of three times. First, saying that he thought that was a really important project to move forward with for many reasons, especially to support the many businesses out here that depend on summer visitors. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, this is an important source of revenue, not just for the town, which collects about $1 million a year in beach parking permits and daily parking fees, but for the whole economic health of the area. But then faced with opposition and questions about whether the plan to expand the lot really made a lot of sense, and the fact that there were probably other alternatives available, they changed their minds. The unfortunate thing to me is a lot of the emails that were sent to town officials about this were not very nice. Selectman Kathleen Bacon said that they had received over 300 very angry, very hateful emails. And I tend to think she's not exaggerating, because I actually was a target myself of some of those emails because of my reports in the paper. And even though the critics probably had some good points, some of them at least were really unnecessarily nasty. And we have to remember, I think, that these are, for the most part, volunteer officials who are doing their best. They're not perfect, and they do make mistakes. But it really makes it difficult to manage a town government when you're faced with this kind of extreme reaction that is very personal.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're so welcome, Steve.
I'm Steve Junker. With me is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. And Jeff, last week the story broke about a Brewster Elementary teacher accused of sexually assaulting 6-year-old students. It turns out that teacher had been investigated for a previous incident at another location. Your reporter, Doug Frazier, did some nice work looking at background checks that teachers face and why the previous incident wasn't even flagged when the teacher was hired in Brewster.
Yeah, that's right. And Doug certainly did a great job with this, Steve. Yes, so this teacher, the 36-year-old Noah Campbell Haley, had apparently been accused of something similar to an assault on a child at a nonprofit school in Eastham. So a lot of people are scratching their heads and saying, hey, Nauset School District, why didn't you catch this?
Yeah.
And it appears as if the school district did all of the required background checks. They did what they were supposed to do, but they were still not able to detect this complaint, which happened in 2010. And why? Because the schools don't have access to a database where this could have been found. The Brewster police found it on a interagency database where they can actually find out who may have been under investigation, what it was all about, even if it didn't involve any type of punishment or indictment or whatnot. And they were able to find this. The school was pretty much using the criminal offender record information check, a Corey check.
Corey, yeah.
Yeah, and that involves, you know, you'll find someone who has been convicted, or maybe not convicted, but they, you know, they've been charged with something. But it does not give you access to any sealed juvenile or other offenses that may have come up. And this cross-agency search database that Brewster used, that the schools can't access, they found this in there. But as the Nauset superintendent said, if there was a problem with any teacher, no matter where they be, it would follow them throughout their career. But since this happened at a private school, private nonprofit, they wouldn't have picked it up. So
we are going to go to the break now. This is the News Roundup with us from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. When we come back, we're going to hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. With me is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. And joining us on the phone right now is George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve, and good morning, Jeff.
Hi, George.
George, I want to circle back to the ferry issues that just don't seem to end. I'm interested in your take on this. I know that you've experienced some of this firsthand.
Listeners may or may not know that I'm a daily commuter on the ferry, and so I've been seeing some of this firsthand, as many of our employees here at the Times have. We're breaking news on this even when we don't want to. You know, last night, for example, as Sarah mentioned earlier, the Martha's Vineyard went back into service yesterday. I was arriving back into Woods Hole on my fast ferry trip across the Sound, and there were passengers coming off the Martha's Vineyard, which should have left at 5 o'clock. So I started asking questions, and sure enough, it had been shut down because of an issue with the door. Now, this lasted a little over an hour. It sat in port. Finally got the clearance to go at about 6:15 last night on its trip, an hour and 15 minutes late. You know, and this is the type of thing, it's so fluid. We're breaking news on this long before even the Steamship Authority is getting the word out to its customers. In fact, on this particular thing, they never even alerted anybody that there was an issue. Only the people there affected by it knew it. And so, you know, people are being delayed hours upon hours as a result of some of these breakdowns. That means missing medical appointments. That means missing connections to Peter Pan buses that will bring them to the airport if they're traveling. I mean, this, you can't underestimate or overemphasize, I should say, that this is really a lifeline. I mean, I'm inconvenienced as a commuter. That's not really that big of an issue. But people are trying to go see sick parents. People are trying to, as I said earlier, get to medical appointments.
And there must be businesses. There must be businesses on the island which depend on the timely deliveries.
Absolutely. It's affecting businesses here. Anecdotally, I heard someone in line the other day. He was going over on the fast ferry. He works in the concrete business over here, but the truck wasn't going to get on one of the freight ferries because there simply wasn't enough room on them. They don't have the capacity of the bigger ferries. So he's going to come over here, but will he have work when he comes over here? You know, these are the types of things that people are going through, and it's gotten to the point where people walk up to the ferry with one eye covered. You know, what am I going to face when I get here? Am I going to get on my ferry, or am I going to stand in this long line and wonder if I'm going to get on or not? So it's become a real issue. The island home, as Sarah mentioned earlier, that was supposed to be back not last week, 2 weeks ago initially. It was supposed to be back on the 17th, and then last week, and then it was supposed to be back today. And now they're saying at the earliest it's Saturday or Sunday. And so that's been out of service for months now for routine maintenance, and they're finding issues with it, you know, just as it's going to come back. There's no confidence. There's a crisis of confidence with the Steamship Authority right now.
Well, George, what do you hear from the governor and the state delegations on this? I know the Times was pushing to get some comment from them.
Yeah, so they finally did, after us pushing for about a week, we did finally get comment from both the governor's office and also the local representatives saying that, first of all, they're offering their assistance. So far, the Steamship Authority has said that they don't need state assistance with this issue. But they're also saying that the communication needs to improve. And that seems to be the across-the-board issue here, is communication. You know, the Steamship Authority, it's 2018. They don't have a Twitter account. They had a Facebook account at one point, but they don't even they don't have it up anymore, and they don't give regular updates on that. I mean, this is where people get their information these days, and they're not there where their customers are. It's just it's unbelievable for some of the people who rely on the ferry service that communication is so poor in a time where we can get instant information out to people, and there are plenty of avenues for them to do that. In fact, just letting us know what the issues are. Sometimes we're asking questions, but we're not getting answers 2 or 3 hours later. It's just not acceptable to some of their customers.
George, let me ask you one more question. The Board of Governors for the Steamship Authority Ferry, the rep on the Vineyard, what's the take on this?
Yeah, so Mark Hanover has come out and said that this is unacceptable. He's asked for a complete review. He wants a consultant to come in. Initially, they had even considered having Wayne Lampson, who was the former general manager, do this. But Mark Hanover is saying now, no, we need someone from the outside, someone who doesn't have a stake in this ferry service, to take a look at what's gone on here and make a determination what needs to be done to right the ship.
Hmm. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks for joining us. I don't think we've heard the last of this story.
No, I don't. We'll be watching it, both as passengers and as a news agency as well.
George, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to jump over now to Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, a New Bedford city councilor has filed suit against St. Luke's Hospital, where he had worked and from which he was fired. This is a bit of a complicated story, but give us a sense of what's happened here.
So, yeah, okay. Back in June, Brian Gomes, he's a longtime city councilor in New Bedford. He's a former council president several times, and he was a one-time mayoral candidate. So he was fired from his job at St. Luke's. And he filed suit against the hospital's parent group, South Coast Health. He's asking for $1.5 million in damages for wrongful dismissal. Now, Gomes had worked at St. Luke's Hospital for almost 30 years and was most recently a technician in the anesthesiology department. And so this hospital responded to his suit, noting multiple complaints against Gomes, and that ultimately led to his dismissal. So there's a lot of interesting items in the lawsuit. Typically in these things, you know, you don't get the participants in the lawsuit to communicate. We had actually had heard a little bit about this story quite a while back and tried to pursue it, and it wasn't until the lawsuit was filed that we could get the court documents and really start to pull string on this thing and try to find out what happened. So the hospital says at least one female coworker accused Gomes of inappropriate behavior on two separate occasions. And the first one was in September of 2015, and that led to a five-day suspension for Gomes and a written warning. Yes. So then in January of 2017, the same female coworker left work alleging there was a toxic work environment created by improper conduct it would be Gomes. And so she posted that on Facebook saying she had been subject to that toxic environment. And last spring, there was an MCAD complaint that was filed. Now, the court documents don't specifically say it was about Gomes, but the complaint led to this independent investigation at the hospital. And the hospital said that the investigation revealed threatening, disruptive, harassing, and intimidating behaviors by Gomes. And so the hospital said that was the last straw and he was terminated. Now, Gomes' attorney told us the Facebook post and the MCAD complaint were both filed by the same person and they were both related to an event in 2015. And here's what Gomes says happened. So he claims he saw the female employee who was a friend's girlfriend using her cell phone in the hallway at the hospital. And so in the court documents, he said he approached her and he explained that cell phone use was frowned upon. And the complaint claims the woman took offense to him. Later, Gomes said he apologized and afterward he hugged her. And so the South Coast Hospital said that the coworker complained that Gomes had engaged in a series of inappropriate, physical, aggressive, and intimidating and disruptive behavior. So, you know, there's two sides to this story and it's going to take a while to sort out, which one is which, one is correct. And so most of the writing that we had to do was done from court documents. The hospital wouldn't comment during an ongoing legal matter. And Gomes referred comments to his attorney, George Leontire. Now, you may have heard that name before in a very other prominent case. He was on the legal defense team for Aaron Hernandez. He said that although sexual harassment is a serious issue in the workplace, not every complaint has its merit, Leontire said. He said that this was hospital violated its obligations to Gomes. And he says they're going to show that they used an improper purpose, which was their decision-making process. And they fired Brian in order to protect themselves from the MCAD complaint.
Andy Tomolonis from SouthCoastToday.com and New Bedford Standard Times. Andy, thanks for bringing us up to date on that.
Okay, one more thing, Steve. Mm-hmm. You can find this story on South Coast Today, but we also have the court documents up on the website as well at SouthCoastToday.com.
Very good. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Jeff Spillane with me here from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, an East Falmouth woman has been charged with stealing $630,000 from a Bourne car dealership. It turns out she had admitted to taking money from a previous dealership she worked at as well.
Yeah, this is one, Steve, that just really leaves you a scratch in your head. This woman, she's a 50-year-old. Her name is Christine Atwood Calverley. has pleaded guilty Wednesday. I'm sorry, she was arrested and was charged with larceny over $250 by single scheme. Looks as if over the course of about 5 years, she stole about $600,000 from Nissan of Bourne. Mm. The former owner of the dealership late last year was taking a look at the books, realized that she was writing checks for herself and forging his signature and also stealing money from petty cash. And so he raised this to the Bourne Police Department. They got the okay from the district attorney's office to take a look at her bank accounts. Sure enough, large deposits of cash were being deposited into her accounts the same times that she was writing these checks. But this is a part that a lot of people are confused about.
Uh-huh.
It's not the first time she's worked as an office manager for a car dealership and stole money. And this just happened a few years ago, 2009, in Harwich. And she pled guilty and admitted that she stole $43,000 from a Chevrolet dealer down there. She gave herself bonuses, extra vacation pay, gave herself discounts on cars that she bought, even marked her repair bills as paid. But a lot of people are wondering, you know, Harwich and Bourne, they're not exactly that far apart, and this is not a large place here, Cape Cod. Why didn't somebody, you know, put up a white red flag that something was going on? So, an interesting one.
There was... I'm just looking at the – we have a few stories here in just a few minutes. I want to get to one that is a nice remembrance of Janice Mills, who was a real figure in the Mashpee community. And let's see. Or maybe if you're – we've got a big stack of papers here we're working through.
Janice, yes, definitely. Janice, and I have had the opportunity to meet her several times. Uh-huh. I live in Mashpee. Wonderful woman. She had spent 38 years on the Mashpee School Committee, actually the longest-serving school committee member in the state of Massachusetts. She died on March 15th, I believe it was in Florida, and she helped build the Mashpee school system from the ground up. I mean, schools. There wasn't a school district. There wasn't, I believe at one point they worked with Sandwich, and the schools were on the on Otis, on the base. So she really was a living history for the Mashpee schools. Also, the former wife of Earl Mills, who was the chief of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe for a while. And a lot of people may know her as the co-owner of the Flume restaurant, which was iconic in Mashpee. I'm saying it's been going to be close to two decades now, but a lot of people remember it with fond memories. So really, a piece of Mashpee history is gone. And there will be a celebration of Janice's life this spring at the old Indian Meeting House in Mashpee.
And, Jeff, let me ask you about one more question here, mm-hmm. which is about the Bourne – one more story here. The Bourne Town Meeting voters this week decided to reject a ban on marijuana shops. It was kind of a confusing question, I think, and left a number of people – uncertain which way they had voted, even it sounded.
It did, and Ethan Genter, who covered this for the Times, he really did a good job in covering this because it really did sound very confusing. But at the end of the special town meeting, which was only four articles on it, the voters did reject two articles proposing a ban on recreational marijuana in Bourne. Some claim they're confused, but it looks like it's going to move forward here in Bourne, even though one man said he doesn't want the town to become the Amsterdam of Cape Cod.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com. I want to thank all our other contributors as well. We heard from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Ed Miller, the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.